Mr. Carter, Reel 19. Are we now moving to about the time of the breakout from Normandy, Mr. Carter?
Yes.
What happened to you then? What are your memories of that?
Well, we got our transport and we started, I think we went through valleys.
Do you remember the scenes?
Oh, yeah, terrible. The 1,000 bombers had been over it. And they flattened me. I remember seeing one of the tanks from previous attacks, one of our tanks, burnt out. And beside the tanks was the graves with the helmets and rifles and unknown British soldiers buried beside the tank. The Germans would have buried them there.
Is this Villers-Bocage, where the big raid went?
Yeah.
What was the scene that you saw moving into the town?
Well, there was nothing to see. It was all flat.
There must have been quite a lot of civilians killed.
Oh, there would be a lot of civilians killed, yes. At any rate, we were on the move, and I was with our company. We had to go ahead for big billets out, you see. And this here, captain, he was what we called Black Jack. He had a jeep. I think there were about four sergeants, including me. And we went ahead to prepare places for to stop the night. And we flew up them roads, but they were grand straight roads. And the battalion then would come and join us, and we'd take them to the billets for the night. And we carried on like this, I think, about 4 days, till we got over to Belgium.
Do you recall going through the pocket, the flayed pocket with the German dead and all that, you know, that had been trapped there? Do you recall going through that area?
I missed that.
You missed that?
Yes, to the right of it.
So then you would go forward to the River Seine?
Yes. And into Belgium. And oh, there was one time it was getting late, I know. And we'd come to a stopping place. And one of the sergeants, we were in a cow shed. And one of the sergeants said, he said, I'll have my platoon in here. I said, you won't. I said, we'll spin for it. And old Black Jack said, yes, that's correct. So we spun for it. And I won, mate. So my platoon got the cow shed for the night. Well, we got over the border. We knew we were in Belgium because every house had the Belgian flag out.
Was it a great reception for you?
Great reception, all flags out. And we got to a place called Alst. It's just aside of Brussels. Because the Guards Armoured Brigade went into Brussels. And we stopped there. I think we were there about 4 days. And
had you come across any of the Free French fighters in your journeys through France and into Belgium?
No.
You hadn't met any of those?
No. But I think in this house they were rounding up some of the collaborators. We just had this truck to live in or something, and the CSM we got, he was a 2nd Battalion man, and he started doing drill with the lads, which I thought was wrong, because there were a lot of newcomers that they wanted training on the Piat gun and this and the other, and what the hell was drilled to them at that time, you see. So me and another sergeant, we cleared off into Holst, and we went into this cafe. They had a gramophone playing. Oh, and the rumour was going round. The war was kaput. Hitler was in Spania. They're all rejoicing. And they were playing this record, Siegfried Line. We went out to watching on the Siegfried Line. So, this here, looking, Belgium in charge of this here canteen, he was giving us drinks. He had a young daughter, so I gave her my emergency ration, which was a chocolate. And then he showed me his leg, put his trousers up, and he showed me where the Germans had kicked him. It was all bruised and that. Any rate, we were in there, and a Belgian came in, and he said, "You've come all the way across France," he said, "and haven't you had a woman?" We said, "No." And just then, he must have been a pimp, a woman came in, and she went upstairs. He said, "Go on, get away up there." My mate went first, and I went second.
Did you have to pay?
No. He was a married man and all. He says, "That's the best bit I've had for a long time." So, anyway, we weren't there long before we were ordered to move. And this sergeant, who said he'd been a sergeant for a long time, who Lofthouse had said to him, "You're going to earn them stripes." Well, CSM had given him a landmine, one of them was it? Silly bugger had primed it. So we moved forward, it dark, and we went into this ditch, and he must have either dropped it or sat on it, and that was the end of him. We crossed the Albert Canal, and we lost the radio in it. And then we came to some farmhouses, and we had a bit of a battle in the dark.
Had there been any opposition at the canal in your area?
No, we crossed it all right, till we came to these houses. And one was set on fire, and they went withdrew. Of course, I was left with my platoon forward again. See, right forward. And here's where I slipped up, because I wasn't the senior sergeant then. The senior sergeant went back to company headquarters and he never came back no more, so I was left in charge. I should have known better that there'd be a counter-attack in the morning. I should have prepared my position better, but I didn't. I got slipshod. Of course, they got round us. An officer came up like and they shot him straight away, and a few more lads, and they got round us, and that was it, we were in the bag.
What were your feelings at that moment?
My feelings were this: we were advancing that quick, I thought I wouldn't be a prisoner for long.
How did they treat you initially?
Well, they put us in, we marched a long way, and then they put us in camps at night. One was a concentration camp.
Were there other inmates in it?
There was some. I could see all wearing the striped jackets like, but I didn't know whether it was electrified. There was electric around the campus to make an escape. It could have been given that. If I'd known it was not electrified, I would have gone through that wire.
Did they treat you roughly as you went along?
No. We finally went through quite a lot of villages, and then we got transport, and then we went to this camp in Holland, I think. It was a doulag, what they call a doulag. That means not a permanent one, it's one where they sort you out and send you, you see. And at that time, there was a lot of airborne. It was the time of the airborne landing.
It was September.
When they landed at
Arnhem.
Arnhem, yes. There were a lot of them in. There was Americans and God knows what. And our first meal there was mangoes. Good, it tasted horrible. Couldn't stomach then.
Have they fed you on the march to this camp?
Yes, they fed us on the march. A bit of bread and that. Yes, we tried it. But this was our first meal with them. But it was depressing, and the camp was depressed. You know, we slept on soots. There was straw to sleep on. We were in a big marquee tent. Then all of a sudden, they issued us with Red Cross parcels, 1 foot between two. And the atmosphere changed just like that. And they were going around swapping, say, cigarettes for so-and-so, some that didn't smoke and some that didn't. It changed altogether, the atmosphere.
It picked you up a bit, didn't it?
It picked us up a lot, you see. And I walked round the camp, and again I heard a voice, and I said to myself, I know that voice. And it was one of our 2nd Battalion lads. They called him Jimmy Drew. Now he had been a band boy with the 1st Battalion when they were in Jamaica in the 20s. And he'd come to us in 2nd Battalion when I think they lifted the ban on reservists. Reservists could now claim the service, previous service, for a pension, you see. And quite a few joined us in India, and he was one of them. And one of the old soldiers said to me, he said, you see that little devil there, he said, we were marching around Jamaica, he said, we wanted to fall out, but with him in front of us, we daren't fall out. Of course, he was only a boy then, he wouldn't be carrying a full marching order. And that was Jimmy Drew. And as I say, I recognised his voice again, like. And he'd been in the airborne. But now he got in there. However, we were then split up. The privates were sent somewhere, and the NCOs were collected, and we were put in one of these cattle trucks, I think about 30 of us. And I said, where are we going? And I said, Austria. So we had a long journey to Austria.
What are your memories of that journey? I'll leave you piled into this cattle truck. And it would take quite a while, and you've got all the usual nature functions to perform.
Well, they let us out, like.
They let you out regularly,
yes,
did they?
Yes, they let us out regularly, yes.
About food and water?
Well, all this soldiers were these. So they were all right at them. Italy youth, you have to worry about them, so on.
Well, they'd be a good age, no doubt, with
well,
the, this
age,
stage.
Yes,
yeah.
All this, what was doing escort duty at good age.
And they're still treating you well?
Yes, yes. Well, right.
Did you get the feeling that they knew that they were losing the war? Or was
not actually, but I'll refer to one later. Yes, so we got to this here, Austria. We got out of the train, and it was a short march to this here camp. And the guards, some guards were outside the camp, like, they were old men, and they started to clap. I thought to myself, like, what are they clapping for? Are they grabbing prisoners or what? And one bloke who knew a bit of German said, no, he said, they're clapping for the airborne, for the show they put up in Arnhem. He said, they're clapping for them. So we went into the camp. Anything, photos or anything, were stamped. We had to stamp them with a stalag on it, you see. And this was a camp for NCOs. it was what we called a Nixarbeiterkamp. No, under the Geneva Convention, we couldn't be made to work. See, Nixarbeit. But the Germans had an answer for that. They had three rates of food. You see, their troops came first. They got the best first-class food. The workers got the next class, and we as Nixarbeiters got the third rate, you see, just enough to keep you alive, you see. And it was getting on for winter, November, and the job was, we got it at Red Cross Parcels. But I'm going to mention now a thing that's never mentioned in POW camps. And that was how we cooked our food. They were in parties, was these lads. Now there was South Africans, there was Australians, there was one Canadian, and there was British. Now the Australians never got on with the South Africans. Because if you remember, the Australians saw the siege of Tobruk out for about 3 months, and they were relieved by the South Africans, who gave in within a week or so. So they had no time for the South Africans. They had never got on with them at all. But coming to the Red Cross parties, everything was used. Now the tins, they made a kind of what they called a blower. They got a plank of wood about 3 feet and about 6 inches wide, and they made like a kind of a heater. They joined the tins together and made like a fan that you turn round, and then there was a hopper on top where you could put your meal to warm it, your tea. And even if you tore your Red Cross parcel up, you could get a brew out of it. But it went, you know, like a blacksmith's shop where he blows. Well, this happened here. And there's a bloke here in North Holland, and he has a diagram of this here blower. And I can't understand why it's never mentioned in prisoner of war camps. Because it was a lifeline. Of course you could go into they had a kitchen, but blokes preferred this blower to use their own stuff up.
So you basically cooked your own, yes, very largely?
Yes, out of the Red Cross parcel, because there were all sorts in there.
What was in a Red Cross parcel?
Yes?
What was in a Red Cross parcel?
Well, biscuits, tea, bacon, quite a lot. Of course, the old, what is it, not raisins, we didn't need them, actually. But the problem was getting wood. Now, we slept on bunks, one above the other, two-tiered bunks. Now, every other board on that bunk underneath went for firewood split up to for your blower, and so you managed on that. Now you weren't allowed out after curfew at night time, but somebody discovered round the camp there's a strand of barbed wire away from the main wire, about 2 foot or 3 foot, you see. If you stepped over that, you could be shot. If you were playing football and the ball went over that wire, you could appeal to the guard and he'd give you permission to go and get your ball. Now, they discovered at night time that the searchlight had a blind spot. and it was where this here stake was. So every night that stake disappeared. And every morning this odd German came in, he was doubled up with his odd rifle, and he brought a scarecrow of a poor odd Russian. Oh, that's a scarecrow he was. And he came in with a new stake, and he banged it in. The lads crowded round poor hard Russian, they gave him a bit of bread or a cigarette of it. No. He had no teeth. And as he was led away, going back like, he turned around and he was never green, and he would say, "Morgan?" And we would say, "Yeah, Morgan." And sure enough, next morning he went back like, bring another one in. Well, then it got to after Christmas we had a party. Some Scotch put a play on, and the South Africans put something on, and we put something on. And the New Zealanders, there was two, they were Maoris. They got up and did the Maori dance. The next day, they were that exhausted and they never got out of the bunks no more. We had a wireless, and we got the news. We used to gather at a certain time, give us the news. I had it pelted away somewhere, this wireless.
And be hidden?
Hidden, yes. The guards were real old guards. One odd guard, he used to come in of a morning with his rifle loaded and dewdrops from his nose, and he'd come through the hut like and shout, "Rouse, rouse, rouse!" And we had he was a Nottingham bloke. He was on a top bunk, and he used to crawl to the side and look over, and he'd say, "Greg 30? And this odd German, he'd start mouthing a lot in German, like. So I said to one lads on your job, I said, "What's he saying, mate?" He says, "When war's over," he said, "you lot will stop here and help to build Germany up." You know. And but the sergeant in charge of them, he'd been a prisoner of war in the First World War, and he'd been treated pretty good over in England, so I think he was a big help to us, because he must have given warnings when there was going to be a search or anything like that, you see, to the local in charge of the camp. He was an RSM or something. He was all dressed up like as though he was going on parade, him. So I think finally, this sergeant had to go to the Russian front. Yes. And as I say, we did have a young German officer come, and he was trying to recruit, and he was talking about German culture. And one of the lads said, "Well, do you call that German culture?" And it was a latrine, and it was a trench with a tree trunk right across it. And he'd been there a few years, you see, so it was full up. You had to watch if you went there, which you didn't go regular like, if you fell in there, you so he said, "Do you call that German culture?" So we did get something out of that, because he said, "You can build another one." So they dug another one, you see. And we went for the bath bombs, which was out of this compound. And one of the lads decided to make a break. And we, on the way back, there was a small culvert under the road. And we shielded him, and he went and hid under the culvert. But he was back a few days later. You couldn't escape it, because it was winter and snow, you see. But they did tell me, the old lads, they told me, every spring they had what they called a spring handicap. Though they weren't forced to work, they did volunteer to go out to work. with the object of mostly breaking the boredom and mostly of escaping. But that was in the spring. Of course, this lad was caught and he was put in solitary confinement on bread and water for a few days.
But the treatment was still quite reasonable.
Yes, Yeah, they gave us one meal a day and a bit of bread.
What might the meal be?
Eh?
What was the meal?
Well, it was called skilly, kind of soup, all mixed in, you see. Now, there was a few potatoes in it, and they were like them, what you'd set in the garden, you know, as small as that. And who used to cook it was the French compound. They cooked it, they brought it in this big tin-like thing and put it at the gate, and you went with it, got it helping out of it. And finally we said, maybe it was a good move, we said, you don't want him peeling, take it, leave the jackets on. It maybe was a good thing because all the vitamins is in the skin, isn't there? And this lad here, who I was talking about, from Nottingham, when they went for the, what we call skill, he didn't go. He had his Red Cross flag and he didn't go. And he had a saying, he would say when they come back, what's it like? Can you walk on it? Oh, he was a great lad, and he had a fiddle he used to play. And, anyway, towards the end, I started bringing, spring was coming, it was warming up. And we'd got a compound through into that next compound, which was the French. I cut a wire through that. And there was some of the Germans walking about gardening with these. And then the lads were up in the top. And they were cutting every other support of the building, which held the roof, for the blower. So I kept the wheels on. I mean, if a good storm had come, snow, the roof would have come down on top of us. But it was spring then, and it was getting on to May. And
you got Red Cross parcels regularly, did you?
No, not so bad. Yes, we didn't do bad at the Red Cross parcels. I said everything in the Red Cross parcel was used. I mean, we had no paper for toilets, so you could tear the Red Cross parcel into strips, you know, suppose, and use that. Everything was used, nothing wasted in the Red Cross parcel. And what was I going to tell you now? Oh, it was getting on, warming up, and we knew the war was coming to an end.
What was the German outlook at this point in time when you were getting near the end? Were they becoming worried about the Russians coming?
Well, I couldn't understand German.
You didn't get that close at all.
But I said this old German when he said you'll stop behind and look to me. That was his attitude. So we knew it was coming to an end.
Was it difficult for him? I mean, you obviously, those in the camp who'd been there many years, presumably.
Yeah.
And then you yourself were, in effect, taken prisoner when the war was going to be won. You knew it was going to be won.
Yeah.
So it must have been very difficult for you to settle into a prison camp after so much, what shall we say, freedom and the victories that were coming with it.
No, there were answers for news and that. Fresh faces, right? Which you can imagine was.
Were there any troubles through boredom in the camp?
No, there was no trouble at all, no.
Any thieving between the inmates themselves?
No, no. There was just this feeling between the South Africans and the Australians over to group.
You'd be disciplined on the same lines as you would have been with your battalion, were you, within the camp?
We were just called out for roll call and counted, and that was all.
Who was the senior British person in charge?
He was in a cavalry regiment. With his badge, his cap badge, I think he was.
Was he an officer or a high?
He was just RSM.
RSM.
Yes. Because officers had their own camps.
Did you have a medical presence in the camp? Doctor or?
I don't think so.
Medical room?
There might have been a medical orderly somewhere. Among all them men, there could be a medical one. But we didn't need them.